You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Comedians Comedian Podcast. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm going to be talking to Ben Norris, who, as well as being one of the funniest people socially that I think I've ever met, is an incredible improviser. He's got really good jokes, but we're going to be talking in the episode today about his quest to release himself from the confines of his prepared material, to activate his demon, more on that later, and find in himself a kind of free and energetic and sometimes quite manic energy that then leads him onto greater heights of creativity. So we probably won't making it be sound that pretentious. Maybe we will. There'll also be a couple of boneheaded references to the Hulk. So Ben Norris today, and I think that's going to be a lot of fun. I think you're really going to enjoy this one. Very different to the conversations we've had so far. And remember, coming up later in the series, we've got Paul Sinha on political comedy. And I've just yesterday recorded a fascinating interview, genuinely electrifying chat with Adam Bloom, who is in many ways the janitor at the bottom of the basement of comedy, fixing jokes for people, and sort of the only guy maybe who understands how jokes really work on a sort of technical exploded diagram kind of a level. That's probably going to make less sense to you now than it will after you've heard that episode. So look forward to Paul Sinha and then Adam Bloom after this conversation with Ben Norris. A tiny bit of admin. You've been sending me lovely feedback, and some of that feedback has said stop talking less at the beginning, but I need to say this because at the moment I've got a loyal core of followers and downloaders, so thank you very much for downloading or streaming this on iTunes or SoundCloud, but I am keen that we get more people out there listening to it. I'm convinced that there is value to be had in some of these interviews on the subject of creativity generally, and not just in terms of the lonely sad comedians such as you perhaps who are listening to this on the way back from a gig for 30 quid in Devon. So forgive me if I just spend 1 minute on a couple of little advertorial things. Is that the word? Thank you to everyone who's been following at ComCom Pod, which is the Twitter of this podcast. And I nominate the following people: comedians Matt Green, David Morgan, Andy White, Sarah Milliken, David Whitney, Al Cowie, Nish Kumar, Brian Gittins, and Michael J. Dolan, and the comedy critic Bruce Desso. I nominate you all super goldsmiths. This is a ludicrous thing I've made up, which is just to say thanks to people who have... Yeah, to say thanks to people who've helped retweet my show to their following, to say thanks to them by giving them a name based on my own name. Good work, Stuart. Please join the Facebook group. If you go to comedianscomedian.com, there is a button there. You can join the Facebook group and share the latest episode on your own Facebook page. And if you'd like to see me do some stand-up, I'm going to be performing at Old Rope, which is a fabulous night run by the wonderful Tiffany Stevenson at the Phoenix in Cavendish Square near Oxford Circus in London. I'm going to be headlining Old Rope on the 21st of May. And what you'll get to experience there is two things. You'll get to probably to see people incredibly incredible comedians like Rich Hall and Stephen Merchant going there and trying out new stuff for their tours or for TV appearances. And then you'll also get to see some poor bastard trying to then headline the show after all the exciting famous people. And on the 21st of May, that poor bastard will be me. I'll be running in some new material for my Edinburgh Fringe show, which in defiance of edfringe.com remains entitled Prick. You can't search for Prick. It needs to be censored. We're trying to fix that at the moment. We're trying to complain. We're trying to take some sort of action. Thank you to Chortle and Jay Richardson, who have helped us raise that. That's sort of an interesting censorship issue, which we might get into in later shows. And thanks to Chortle as well for featuring the Comedians Comedian podcast on their homepage as recommended. They called us quite geeky, which I think is fair. Last thing, tickets for Prick, which is a venue called The Pleasance. They're on sale at edfringe.com. And tickets for the Comedians Comedian Live at the Gilded Balloon. They're going to be on sale soon as well. So please send me your questions, remarks, comments, suggestions for guests. I've had some great suggestions coming in. More of those, please, to info@comedianscomedian.com. That is all the advertorial guff for today. Please enjoy Mr. Ben Norris. So, where are you at the moment with comedy? How are you enjoying it? How's it treating you?
Good, actually. I think I've been going through a healthy regenerative period where I'm, you know, I think anyone in stand-up who's been doing it a long time goes through peaks and troughs, and there are times when it's not, it doesn't feel quite as much fun and as creative and fulfilling. It can be, you can go through spells of where you're just working, and it feels like working because you've got a gig every night, and you've got to travel so far, and it, you know, if you feel less inclined to muck about with the set too much because it's kind of working, and that's a very professional sort of way to be, I think, to have a 20-minute set that kills at every gig and all of that stuff. But actually it can start eroding your joy of it a bit. So I think every now and then you just have to kind of check yourself before you wreck yourself.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And where are you on that wave at the moment? Are you in the kind of I've been doing that for ages and now I'm feeling a bit more alive and stuff?
I started trusting the a number of friends and pals on the circuit would say to me, "Oh, really, you know, there's nothing wrong with your set, don't get me wrong, but I love it when you go off piste, and every opportunity you get to just go into the audience or into your imagination with a bit or extend an idea that you've got tends to be more enjoyable, certainly for the comics, because they get used to a certain rhythm and patter and frankly, let's face it, we get to know each other's acts quite well.
Inside out, yeah.
And, you know, if you've been working quite a lot with somebody, it's always a joy if they do anything that you didn't hear Thursday night, you know? Yeah. So I kept getting people saying, "Oh, I really loved it last night when you went off on that thing, and you're so good at that. Why don't you do that more often?" And I could tell people were trying to be careful about how they put it to me because they were worried that I would take it like, what's wrong with my material, you know?
Sure.
But they were, you know, and for years I've always done that. I've always done that occasionally or, you know, one every three or four gigs. But just recently, like in the last 6 months, I decided I was going to try and do it always, but for at least a large spell of my act, or as often as possible. As you know, there's some gigs you turn up, that might be your intention.
Yeah, definitely.
And you glance at the room and think, "No, this isn't the playroom. This is the do the act room and get out of here with my head down." But and I've had some really lovely, you know, gigs where I'm closing out of town and there's genuinely no time restriction where they say, you know, there's not a compere looking at his watch saying, "I've got to get the last train," and I've just let myself play a bit, and I think I've proved to myself again that I can do large chunks of improvised stand-up that are as good or better than anything I've written. So that's I'm feeling quite positive because I've done quite a few where I've proved to myself that is the case and it can be done.
I'm just waiting for a second for you to stop because I'm just going to rust these. We're rustling slightly. Yeah.
So you'll have to edit this bit.
Yeah. Hang on. After three. One, two, three. That'll stay in. Okay. So
you're feeling freer in what you're doing?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
not giving yourself the opportunity to go. I mean, is it a case of trusting yourself enough to know that you can just jump in there and you'll be okay now?
Yeah.
You're good enough now.
Yeah, I think so. Thing is, I always used to do that without the trust. It was through the fear of the thing. Like when I started doing stand-up, I was a compere in a monthly gig. And I didn't have any material, so I had to do
Let's place you there then. So this is when you started. You started as a compere.
Yeah. Well, I started a gig in an arts centre in Aldershot. The gig's still running, I think, at the West End Centre.
Okay. Who's that yours?
That was mine originally. It's called the Trapdoor Comedy Club. It was monthly on a Sunday.
And that was, you started that in order to become an open spot?
No, I started it because I wanted some comedy in my town, you know.
Okay.
And I approached the Arts Centre where I used to be in bands and play a lot of gigs there in various guises playing bass guitar. And so they knew me a little bit, and I'd started going up to Clapham. There was a gig called The Cartoon at a pub called The Plough in Clapham. It was a Friday night gig. It was maybe 250-seater and a really exciting, gritty kind of, you know, if they loved you, they carried you shoulder high, and if they didn't like you, people were brutal. And it was the early 90s, and people were the heckling thing seemed to be quite big then.
Yeah, much more of a thing then, I think, than now.
Yeah, I think people were, it was still alternative comedy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
So people had opinions, and people disagreed with them.
Yeah, absolutely. Most bills, there would be two or three acts who were coming at comedy from some sort of left-wing bias, and one or two deliberately trying to sabotage that, but whichever angle, it was alternative comedy. It was not on the telly,
and it made for a very provocative live. We're all here, and anything can happen.
And then there were other people who were deliberately going to heckle. I think there were people who definitely were turning up with, and not heckle like you might get heckled at, you know, some jonglers or other by some drunk postal worker, but you know
whenever I read or listen to people talking about you know, back in the day, man, you know, and the heckles and the heckle stories, the hecklers in those are always really intelligent, and I guess they would be because those are the stories that are filtered back. But now, I mean, I can't think of a really intelligent or funny heckle.
It's so rare, isn't it? I was watching a documentary on the telly the other day about Leighton Live.
Brilliant.
There was an example of that reminded me of those early days when people went specifically to heckle, but not just to shout, but to say something that might destroy a person, you know,
to try and test that comedian. Like the comedian had to test himself or herself against the best everyone can come up with.
Yeah, people were
like, I'm prepared, I'm going to stand here and I'm going to take on all of you.
Yeah.
Can't bring it on, kind of thing.
Yeah, it was very gladiatorial. And I used to go there as a punter and sit in awe of these people who appeared to be able to do that. And I can't imagine now, after sort of 18 years of doing this, I can't really imagine the me then.
Mm.
And I certainly the me then couldn't imagine this.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought it was something that people had who had either special powers or severe mental illness did. Mm-hmm. Turns out it was the second
combination of both. The one leading to the other. Okay, so you wanted comedy to be in your town, so you...
Oh, that's right. So I was going to this club, The Cartoon, and I approached the manager of the West End Centre in Aldershot and said, why don't you have these guys come and do a night here? And we were chatting about it, and he said, well, we've tried comedy here and it didn't really work. And I said, well, I'm amazed because it's brilliant. And my enthusiasm was obviously rubbing off on him. And he said, well, you sound like you're the man for the job. Why don't you promote a night? So, and that was it. He just gave me, he said, you can have this Sunday at the end of next month and go and roll it out from there. And that's also tells you a lot about the state of affairs, that I was able to go back to The Cartoon at Clapham. I met one comic, Noel James.
Oh, no, Noel. Yeah, yeah.
He was the first comic I ever spoke to directly. I just saw him die on his ass.
Okay.
But brilliantly. Me and about two other people were rolling around with laughter.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else was. He set his hair on fire as his finale. And I just had to go and talk to him. And I went to talk to him and I said, look, this guy wants me to book a gig. Mm-hmm. Can you help me? And he took my address, and a couple of days later, he sent me a photocopy of the back of his diary. And all comics in those days used to just carry small you know, mm-hmm. Collins' diaries. Mm-hmm. And in the back of Noel James's diary was, this was about 1992 or something, it was the phone number of every famous alternative comic working. Amazing. Yeah, okay. Them all. You know, some of them were already famous by that point. Mm-hmm. And I was flicking through, and he'd crossed some out quite badly, okay. Where perhaps he thought, you better not ring him.
Okay, but you could still make it out.
Yeah, yeah. And I was just so excited at these numbers. And from that photocopied notebook, I booked the first night.
Okay, so when you had initially gone to the guy in Aldershot and said, I want to do comedy, what comedy had you seen then? Were you going to London gigs?
I was going to this gig in Clapham pretty much every Friday, and I'd been doing that for about a year.
And who stands out in your memory as people that you saw at the time?
So many of them are... So few of them are still working. Mm. One or two. Ivor Dembina.
I went with Ivor on last weekend, yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah. He was there. Very, very, very funny. Who else was there? Who else did I see? Some people who... Who's that... guy who went on to be a playwright and
Mark Billingham.
No, not him. No, much more famous than that, but very high profile.
Patrick Marber.
Yes.
Yeah.
Saw Patrick Marber there did a routine about being debagged by a landlady.
Okay.
Which sticks in my mind. My memory is appalling. I wish I'd written these all down. I could have prepared them.
No, that's
but lots of people. One or two are still working. One or two have gone on to be famous and rich, and a number of others who've disappeared off the face of the earth.
So, what? And how were you coming at it then? Were you thinking, I'm in bands, I'm into being on stage and being the guy, or were you thinking, I've got a political agenda, or there was stuff I wanted to say? What was the thing that made you want to go, I can do it? Was it the everyone loves these guys, I want to be loved?
I thought it was genuinely pure excitement of bringing these comedians to Aldershot, mm. and having any kind of involvement with them. I was happy just to be the guy on the flyer, you know, that said I booked the guys, you know. But it became quickly apparent that we couldn't afford to pay three acts plus a compere, and I wanted a three act bill like I was seeing in London. Sure. So I just said, well, I'll just go on and introduce them. And of course the acts would say to me, well, you'll do a bit, you know, like we all do. Yeah. And I said, well, I'll chat for a bit. I mean, I haven't got any stuff, you know.
Yeah, I'll say thank you 114 times.
But of course it was a really small but well-meaning crowd, 60 or 70 people if I'd done really well. And they were just genuinely delighted that somebody had thought to bring this thing to crummy little Aldershot, as everybody sees it there. So they were grateful to me and made it easy for me to get gentle laughter going. So I would, maybe I'd have written two bad jokes and then I would talk about something local, you know, something out of the, you know, Aldershot Times or whatever. And get every month I wrote a few more bits and it became completely addictive. And then comics who I was booking started saying, it's very scruffy what you're doing, but it's got something. Mm-hmm. You know, it needs a lot of work, but you shouldn't think that you're just the guy who brings on acts here, because you could be an open spot.
You know?
I didn't even know what an open spot was, you know. Yeah. And then they told me, you can do these unpaid 5-minute gigs in these bars around London, and you turn up at 7 o'clock and write your name in a book. And and at the time, I think it was really quite a fledgling scene, that open spot world. This wasn't it wasn't at clubs where you were trying to get a gig at that club. It was bars that just did open mic nights, and they probably still exist, but I haven't been to one for a long time. But I used to go to one called The Bar in Willesden that one of these comics told me about. And I remember I think the first night I went, Paul Tonkinson was also queuing up to sign his name in the book, and Rudy Liquid. Can't remember anyone else. Oh, that Corran woman, what's her name, who's now on the radio quite a bit. Victoria
Corran.
She was trying her hand at stand-up. Uh-huh. And these people would turn up every Monday night. I think it was a Monday night. And you'd see them perfecting little bits. And
so if your beginnings as a comic were just being up there and saying stuff, you said you might have had some bad jokes that you'd written. What was the beginnings of your writing process? What did you think, oh god, I've got to come up with something at the last second? Or were you how much thought were you giving it at the time?
I started giving it more and more thought, because every month it became, like a week before the gig, it became apparent that I'd done everything. I'd done all the important bits, like I'd booked the three acts and I'd photocopied the posters and the flyers and dropped them off at the venue and, you know, done all that stuff. And then it became apparent, oh, Christ, I've got to introduce all these people. And I got the feeling that the regular audience were starting to enjoy my predicament. You know what I mean? There was a kind of conspiratorial vibe. What will this drunk do this week? And I would have a few pints before I went on. So there was a definite Dutch courage thing going on. And I started really enjoying it, you know, getting excited.
That does sound like a really, and it's a kind of a hated word, but that sounds like a really organic beginnings of a comic.
Yeah.
Story. Do you know what I mean? It sounds like a really good, honest kind of beginning of a movie type, you know, Billy Elliot kind of comedy thing.
Well, I didn't have to, you know, I didn't feel like I was going to be judged harshly at all.
Mm.
I could go out there and be awful, but they would still smile at me as if to say, listen, Ben, that was an interesting try, but can you bring one of those comics
on? Given that you're one of us, you've done fine.
Now bring one of those guys on that you told us about. And of course, the pedigree of the people I was booking was really high. So every month on this Sunday night gig, they were getting at what I felt to be the best of the alt circuit.
Mm.
So they trusted me completely with regard to my comedic vision. It was just the stuff I was saying that was a bit dubious. But even that started getting funnier because it was so amateurish but so honest. And I think that's what people used to say about what I was doing, is that I was just mining my genuine private life and awful, embarrassing things that had happened to me and my family, and just splurging it all out on stage. And people were surprised by that level of honesty, because most of the other acts weren't, you know, doing that. They were professional and snappy and rude and outrageous, but they weren't going, so the other day I actually pooed myself in Devon.
Yeah. Okay. You were sort of ahead of the curve in terms of bearing your soul this is the awful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it was easier to get a reaction from something cringingly embarrassing that had happened than sit and write some proper jokes, you know.
So were you, before you got into liking comedy, were you funny in the pub? Were you the sort of person that, you know, were you funny at school?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I probably fall into a lot of those cliches about trying to protect myself by being amusing. I was a very small kid at school. I was one of those, my voice didn't break till I was about 17.
And okay.
I was a tiny little fellow when I left school. I didn't look like I should have been out in the workplace. I didn't look like I should have been out of the house on my own. So I think that affected my psyche a bit. I think I always thought that I needed to prove myself a bit more than perhaps some of my mates. And when I was a young punk in the early 80s, I suppose, I remember...
Like an actual punk, like hair and safety pins.
Yeah, I had spiky... Yeah. Well, not safety pins so much. We were anarcho-punks.
Mm-hmm.
So we were into bands like Crass and Conflict and Flux of Pink Indians. And we were anarchists and vegetarians. And we spent most of our time going on demonstrations. So we were either going to see a band or we were going on a train to some godforsaken place to stand outside an animal lab with a placard saying, stop hurting the animals, man.
In a leather jacket,
yeah. Actually, we quite often wore ludicrous UPVC-based clothing and shoe products, which pretty much proved why leather is so good.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of standing around, and hunt sabbing was another hobby.
Did you go and do that?
You did that twice a week.
Oh, man. Yeah. I was 11. Yeah. I'd read about people hunt sabbing, and I'd be in Leamington Spa, and I'd be thinking, God, I'd love to do that, and just feeling like I had no connection to that.
It was great. It was, you know, it was. We were revolutionaries in our Surrey Hampshire border kind of way. I was in these bands, these silly bands. Stigmata Club was the name of the band I was in with my cousin Jamie.
Excellent.
And I think that's the earliest memory I have of people gathered around and me taking up the mantle of entertainer.
Okay.
And it would be, you know, probably an evening around somebody's house. We were all teenagers. So, most of them were older than me. I used to always hang around with slightly older groups or groups of people that were slightly older. And I don't know if that's indicative of some psychological thing that's relevant. Someone listening to this might better work that out. So, sorry, I'm rustling on the raffia.
Keep moving things away. Keep moving these out of the way of this man.
But I remember, you know, I do. That's when I remember first getting that feeling of a group of people laughing at something I'd made up.
Mm-hmm.
And the more it happened, the more I wanted to do it. And that was that probably was my reputation in that group as squeaky little, you know, spiky haired Herbert, half the size of everyone else, but with twice the mouth.
Yeah.
And
it's a classic trope, isn't it?
I think so.
Less true for it. So you started gigging regularly. There's a period by which you presumably are doing lots and lots of open spots. Is it a fairly natural curve for you that you did more and more, and then you went one day you went,
yeah, I can't remember the full details, but I think there were so few comics then that there seemed to be, I don't know, 40 established comics, and this may not be right, but it felt like, and they were about 30 people trying to become established comics. That's sort of what it felt like, because I seemed to know by the first year of open spotting, I kind of knew everybody,
yeah,
both established and up and coming.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's not like that at all,
is it?
It's
insane.
I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds, right?
Yeah.
The only time I meet open spots now genuinely is if I'm emceeing the Comedy Store or something,
mm-hmm,
and they're coming to do their open spot there, and by which time they're an established act.
They're not really open spots anymore.
So I don't go to those places where there's a whole load of new acts.
I count myself lucky to have started even 6 years ago, because now it's absolutely mental. An ex-flatmate of mine is on the open spot circuit at the moment and is still driving to the ends of the earth for no money for Jeff.
Wow.
A few years in, because there are just so many people doing it.
Well, it makes me so pleased that I started when I did. I was 26 when I started out, you know. So yeah, it was fairly smooth, because once you had a decent five and you went to nice rooms and it worked, they might make you do it twice,
mm-hmm,
before they gave you a half spot, but usually two unpaid spots, you'd be into a 10-minute paid, and a year later most of them would be 20s, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Year or two, perhaps. I might be exaggerating. But then it was still a long time before I had enough in the diary to even consider throwing in the towel at work.
Sure.
Because my parents brought me up, you know, the whole ethos was don't give up your day job.
And getting the criticism in early.
Yeah. No, but, you know, I mean, don't even consider not working, because there was a period of time when I wasn't working, when I was just going to demos all the time. And my mum was furious, but I was living at home, you know. Didn't need to work.
Mm. Let's talk about the material that you do now. I never like being asked to describe what I do, but I see you doing anecdotal stuff about your life, stuff about your kids.
Yeah.
But also you can write proper jokes.
Right.
You're one of those people who can actually write a joke.
Okay.
Like your unemployed dwarf joke, for example, is just one of my absolute favourites. And it's a proper joke.
Right, yeah.
So let's talk about how you make material of either sort. What do you do when you... I mean, you're not someone that goes to Edinburgh, are you? You don't go to Edinburgh regularly, so you're not
really
forced to make a new hour every year.
No.
But you still turn stuff over.
Yeah.
So what do you sit down in a room somewhere and write? What's the starting
point? I try all the different methods that I've heard other people use. I've tried to get up in the morning and, you know, sit at a desk and just channel ideas. That doesn't really work for me. It doesn't seem to anyway. I try and use all the travelling time that I can use to do that. So trains, I get trains everywhere nowadays, or I take them my motorbike if I can get there and back in the day. The trains are good. You know, I always have a notebook with me. I always have half-baked ideas in that notebook.
Mm.
And I find that if I return to them, sometimes the answer comes to me. But I'm not a prolific writer by any means, which is why I like to improvise. Any chance I get to improvise, and that tends to be when the funny, whatever it is that's funny in me, I exorcise that demon in the moment, and stuff comes out. And half my jokes in my act that are in my established act were improvisations from a previous gig that I just kept in, you know.
So is there something about, what is it for you about that? What's the difference between being in front of an audience? What's the chemical difference for you being in front of an audience compared to sitting trying to come up with a funny idea? Why do you think it is?
I don't know, because what I've tried to do in the past, and I'm desperately trying to write a chunk of new stuff, is imagine that I'm in front of an audience and see if I can get that freewheeling mindset going. And it doesn't seem to open up, you know. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to use a drug analogy, but it's kind of like somebody saying, imagine, you know, sit here now and imagine you're high. And you can do it to a certain extent, but not in the same way as when you're high.
Yeah.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You know, so
is it that must kind of be adrenaline?
It must be. It genuinely feels like a different part of my brain unlocks.
Yeah, you know? I've always thought it's even when, if I write down some ideas and then ring up a friend to say, "Can I try my ideas on you?" Because I'm just bouncing off the walls here, not knowing. I'll often say things, and just in the saying of them, I'll come up with much better stuff than I've written down, because there's this hungry ear on the other side of the phone. There's like this kind of, I don't know what it is. Like you enter, I think I enter a feeling of crisis where you go, I have to fill this.
Yeah.
And it's more important than
that set list show a couple of weeks ago.
How was that? Tell me about that. So we should just say that set list is, this is a show where you walk in and you get given, as you walk up to the stage, you get given what you're going to talk about.
Yeah.
So you have to talk about it literally then.
And I was, Matt Kirsch, and I have to thank a lot, because he's very involved with the show, and it was him that said to Paul Provenza, who I think created the show, you've got to have this guy Ben Norris. And then he managed to remind him who I was, because Provenza had bumped into me one night at Glastonbury about 5 years ago, where at 3 a.m, and there was a group of comics around a campfire, and I was on one of my hour long consciousness, what do you call it?
Stream of consciousness.
Stream of consciousness.
Yeah, what do you call it? There is no word for what you do. You get for those that don't know, Ben, I mean, you're quite known throughout the comedy world, aren't you, for kind of getting on one?
Apparently.
I think some people are kind of always on.
Right.
And you're not always on.
No.
That quality of being always on is something that you sometimes do, to the extent that, like, it isn't annoying. It's normally annoying when people are always on.
Yes.
But sometimes you just get in a gear and you're just going, and you can't do anything as an outsider. You can't do anything but just sit back and cry laughing. You've done that to me before.
Really?
Where we've been, it started off as a conversation and you just, the motor was running.
Yeah.
And I've just been crying with laughter.
Well, that's kind. I mean, and that is the thing that I guess I've been touching upon throughout this interview, is that there's this, there's a demon in me, I guess, that it is a pretty positive one, in that it really does entertain people, but it's also, it's often quite dark and a bit unexpected. It's unexpected because I don't know I'm going to say it until the words literally hit the back of my palate.
It's like you're hulking out. You do this thing, and there's normal Ben Norris, and then there is another state that you turn into.
Yeah.
So, and this is kind of what you were saying before, is at the moment it sounds like you're trying to throw yourself into hulking out.
Yeah, I'm trying to make that happen on stage at normal gigs. Instead of, I mean, the other thing is, there seems to be something about the miniature audience of my peers that excites me the most, or makes this thing do its job the best. And it's, you know, it's not that I'm at Reading Jonglers thinking these people don't deserve the demon.
No, you know. No, but it should be said as well that when you're not doing whatever that thing is, Hulk, the Hulk isn't the right analogy. That's too blunt. It's like...
You won't like me when I'm funny.
Yeah. I can't remember. We don't like you anyway. I can't remember this superhero, but is it the one who goes Shazam? And he's got... It's the Captain Marvel or something.
Right.
And he's the normal person, and then he activates his thing, and like the other...
Right.
I'm sure I'll get emails if anyone listens ever. But, you know, it's like he switches place with a demon from another world.
Yeah.
He kind of goes, think like this, and then the demon's there, and that's the thing he's doing. That's a more. But when you're not doing that, you are still very, very funny. You are still... I mean, you've got... Well, no, it's true, isn't it? You can... One of the quotes on your website, and I totally agree with this, is your... I think it's from londonisfunny.com.
Right.
They say it's as close to a cast iron guarantee of someone being brilliant that you can get. If you go see you headline somewhere... Right. It's definitely going to be great, whether or not the demon comes out. So I just wanted to make that totally clear for the benefit of listeners. You're funny anyway, but this demon thing is... I think it's hilarious that you call it the demon.
I hadn't called it that until just then.
But okay,
then,
you know, good.
It's hard... I'm very conscious of not wanting to sound wanky.
No, do it. Because normally, whenever we have these chats, when everyone goes, oh, I don't want to sound like this, that's what we want to hear, don't worry.
Right.
When, you know, sound as wanky as you want.
But it's... you know, it's quite clear. It's been demonstrated to me by various other people that I like and respect that, you know, there's one or two quotes that I've actually been gaulish enough to put on the website from someone like, you know, Ed Byrne described it in an interview where they asked him, you know, who makes you laugh? And he said me. And he was wasn't talking about my act, even though I'm sure he thinks it's fine. But he was talking about my, you know, 3-hour long... late night shenanigans at various social occasions where I've just done that demon thing, and one or two people have come in and tried to kind of get involved with it and then fallen away because they've realised actually it's best just let him get on with it, and one or two people walk away frankly because they don't really like it, but most people sit and listen, you know, and it's not something I would know how to do tonight if we'd arranged to do it, it's something I need to investigate more because I think it will be the thing that makes me stand out. It's my biggest skill. It's just so bloody hard to find a way of switching it on and off.
Yeah.
And like you say, those people who are always on are rarely bearable.
Yeah.
There's something about that that's just, ooh.
Yeah.
But if somebody in a moment is in a thing...
If you can learn the magic word that wind... If you can learn your Shazam that puts you in that thing... Then that's really exciting.
Yeah.
So you say it comes around. Let's talk. I just want to talk about this a bit more for a bit. You say that comes about more often when you're with peers, when you're with comics. So is that like because they're super audience members? Like the audience makes you want to leap out and.
It's kind of like I won't be able to do any old crap with these guys.
Yeah.
They've heard every pullback and reveal gag and every technical type of joke. So I can just put all of that stuff to one side and concentrate on the thing that seems to be the thing that I'm best at.
So you're not doing technique anymore.
No,
you're just channeling emotions.
Yeah. And it's you know, like in, I don't know if you've ever seen one of these cartoons where the character is laying bricks on a road that he's walking on.
Yeah.
And he's doing it at 30 miles an hour and the bricks are going down just in time for him to continue. Yes. It's like I'm doing that.
Yeah.
And the words are the bricks. And genuinely, I'm running at this thing and chucking the words in front of me. And if they don't land in the right place, I've had it.
Yeah.
And there's something about the jeopardy of that that makes it so exciting. And having people who you know are going to get it. And I'm not, let's be honest, not every audience we play to give us the indication that they're the brightest, buttons or the sharpest tools in the... They're not the sharpest buttons in the fridge. And sometimes we play down to audiences and we might play over the heads of audiences or we might have an audience that seem far too intellectual and suddenly our knob jokes feel... Rather
like knob jokes,
yeah. But if you can put an angle on even a knob joke, you can make it acceptable, I think.
You've described being in this state when other comics are around and, you know, people have tried to get involved. Have people been combative in the past? Have you ended up in kind of almost like put down battles with people who've tried to get involved? To tell us about that, give us an example.
I've been in one or two. I don't need to name names, but I was at there was a bachelor weekend. Is that what you call them? It was somebody's stag.
Okay, got you.
And
I didn't know. I thought that might be a thing I hadn't heard about. I've been on one of them.
Have you not been to a bachelor weekend? Oh, you'd love it. Just bring a bachelor. It was a stag weekend, I suppose, but it was in a big posh house, and it was a quite high-profile comic who shall remain nameless. They all will in this story. But I think it was somebody had started saying, oh, later on, Ben will be...
For the benefit of the listener, high-profile comics include Ed Byrne. I just feel like I should name a list of people. It could be any four of the following 20 people. Dara O'Brien, Andrew Maxwell.
They were all there. But I think somebody started saying, can't be long now before Ben goes off on his thing. You know, the crazy rant will start. And I, you know, obviously I was drinking, etc. And I was genuinely thinking it's not coming. It's not going to happen. I might just sit this one out.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll just be like other people and just listen to other people talk and say the occasional thing and giggle and drink my beer and wander around this massive house that they'd rented and have a laugh. But sure enough, at a certain time of night, it appeared. You know, I started.
Do you remember what started it?
It would have been conversational. You know, and I would have started a thing, got a laugh. And thought, right, here it comes. And a few people going, oh, here we go, here it goes, Norris is doing this thing. And one or two characters inevitably who maybe hadn't seen it before, didn't value it.
Yeah.
They didn't value it. You know, sort of interrupted. And then a few other people go, shh, don't it.
It's happening.
Let him go. It happened once before, and it was, I think it was Glenn Wall's stag night. We ended up, I think it was at Ed Byrne's flat that time, and he put this movie on, a black and white movie made in the turn of the century called, it's a really outrageous film about the Ku Klux Klan.
Okay.
Birth of a Nation. Right. That's what it's called. Right. And somebody put that on and said, we'll just sit in the lounge, we'll turn the sound off and we'll all just voice it. And this was, you know, 2 a.m. And it started with, you know, various different people doing the voices of the characters as they popped up on the screen. And then I just took over.
Okay.
And again, I remember one other comic who stayed in the mix with me being told by the others, there's no point. This is not, just honestly, let Norris do this. And again, this is the bit that I think sounds like I'm blowing my own trumpet. So, you know, but you said I have to go through with it.
Yes, yes. Well, I hereby absolve you of any trumpet playing accusations.
This is what I'm told later. I was a bit drunk, so I can't remember the full details. But I voiced, after the 10 minutes of the movie, everyone else stopped voicing the characters. And I voiced every scene till the film ended. And the lounge of this house was packed full of professional comics, apparently rolling around in hysterics. Now, I don't know if I could ever do that again. I don't know where it came from. I just know that this thing was happening and I just stuck with it. And apparently the movie is 2.5 hours or 3 hours long. So I did the whole movie.
Oh, God.
And every time I kept thinking, right, that was 5 funnies in a row. I'm going to drop this in a minute.
Yeah.
You know, the bricks
another
fell
brick
into place.
Into,
and
it, oh
yeah.
My God.
And blimey. It's something I look back on and I was told by others, that was bloody phenomenal, you know. You know, people would say things like, I'm not saying your act's not good, but Jesus Christ.
Yeah, yeah.
You can do that. And I was and I'm like, well, like, where can I do that? You know, when will anyone ever say, well, you know, I have thought about maybe just sticking on a film like that and doing it in a venue.
Well, let's talk then about the risks that would take, because the first thing that occurs to me is for you to take big risks like that. You know, that's what we're talking about, isn't it? Like free-falling, diving in. You're in a situation now where you have a large family. You've got three
suddenly,
kids.
Yeah,
a sudden large family. You've got triplets that all. How old are they now?
666.
Lovely, good year. Maybe this is your year for the demon. But you've got responsibilities as a father and as a breadwinner and those sort of things. So And also, you've got responsibilities in terms of your family and the time you can spend away. So if you're doing money, if you're doing earning gigs Wednesday to Sunday, or, you know, I mean, I saw you recently at The Hob on a Monday.
Yes.
Night. Yeah. And that was lovely to see you there trying new stuff off a tiny bit of paper and worrying and all the rest of it. But when can you find a time to go, I'm now going to risk this? If you're not, that's the sort of thing I'd do in Edinburgh Preview, and I'd go, right, I'm going to try something really different for this. I've got no dependents. If it's an Edinburgh Preview, it ultimately doesn't matter. Do you feel, I suppose what I'm asking is, do you feel that you haven't taken these risks before because of professional necessity?
I think the obviously there's an element of having to be a husband and a father as well as a comic, and lots of people achieve that with no problem. But things like that new material night, you know, on a Monday, if I've been away, like you say, from Wednesday through, got back on a Sunday, I always feel like I owe my wife a couple of evenings with her.
Of course.
And a lot of those new material nights are on Mondays, aren't they? And I just think, I'm amazed how many people are willing to just, I guess it's, it depends where your life's at, but for me, it's been difficult to do those new material nights. And I'm not sure how much I gain from them. I tend to chuck new stuff in during my normal gigs, or especially if I'm comparing somewhere, which I don't do so much these days, but that always used to be a really nice, easy place for me to chuck in a new line, and it wouldn't be the end of the world if they didn't buy it.
Of course.
But the demon thing, the voice from the back of my head that appears, I'm trying to find a place for it. I'm trying to find a way of proving that might be the thing that I'm the very best at, you know. Or the best I can be, you know. And not many people are doing anything quite like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just finding a place. And it's terrifying, really, isn't it? Because it's...
I mean, ultimately, you've got to go back to the fear of being an open spot.
Yeah.
Haven't you? From you've got to be... You are currently clad in the armour of this amazing opening 10, this rap that I can drop in. And so, do you know what I mean? You've got the sword of these brilliant jokes and the shield of these observations, and you need to kind of run out naked and go,
yes,
is this still good?
Yeah.
Does this work? And if it does, then you become the incredible naked knight, to complete the analogy.
Not one of Disney's more well-known films.
Wildly unpopular.
But as I said, the closest I'm getting is at comfortable closing gigs where they want an extended set, or, you know, at least half an hour. Because if I'm doing 20, I can't get out of third gear with this sort of approach. I believe that I can't. It takes me 15 minutes to get the audience on board with the non-material based act, and then they seem to, if it works, they're absolutely into me doing 40 minutes, no worries. It's just that it's increasingly difficult to find venues that will let you do that between 40 minutes and an hour. And that's what I'd like to, I mean, the most important thing for me over the next year is finding a way of, if I can't do Edinburgh, which it seems I can't somehow afford or justify to my family, then I need to find places I can be on stage for longer, because I need longer.
You need a free fringe in London.
That's it.
That's what you need, really.
Yeah,
isn't it?
I guess something like that. Yeah, and people who are relaxed enough to come in and sit down and just let me trust me a bit, because it usually pays off.
Yeah,
I'm unlikely, I think, to just grind to a halt and say, oh, I'm afraid I've run out of I've run out of humour.
Yeah,
but having said that, you know, there are lots of gigs we probably all do where we're glad we've got a set that we can just bang out, you know?
Sure.
And not that, you know, a lot of people, that's all they ever do is bang out their set, and they bang it out beautifully. There's nothing wrong with that, you know. There's something very professional about being able to resell
any situation and make it new. I might not leave this bit in, because this is not about me, because the podcast is supposed to be about you and not me, but I'm having a similar thing at the moment that might be apposite to talk about. I've got a new bit about trying to convince the audience to have sex. Why don't we all just have sex? And it's an opening bit.
I've seen you do that in bars.
No, that was research for a bit. And I did it last night in Canterbury in the Gulbenkian thing for Barnstormers, Killing Precious gig. And I wrote it on Friday, did it a couple of times at gigs over the weekend. And I'm really kind of gibbering at the minute because I went on last night and I did 7 minutes of trying to convince the audience to all have sex. And I hadn't really written any of it. I was just making it up. And I was standing there and I was feeling I didn't know what was going to happen next. Mm. And that was fine because I felt totally in control.
Were you closing the show?
I was closing the show. Yeah, exactly. Right. Again, it's like that thing of if you're headlining, then you have the space maybe.
I think so.
But at the same time, if you're headlining, you've got the responsibility.
I mean, in some ways, you'd think you could go on in the middle and try something like that.
Yeah.
And the evening wouldn't be a washout because someone's going to come on and close.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, I think there's too much responsibility for shifting the gig into a weird mindset and then saying to your colleagues, well, sorry about that.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas good luck.
If you're on last, you can't have ruined anyone else's work.
No.
And if you're on last, you're king of the audience, you're king of the show.
Yeah.
And you get to come out and say, well, tonight the king is going to take some absurd risks.
Yes.
So maybe it does feel better. In that sort of environment.
And I think they don't know what your act is or your agenda, unless they've come to see you before. And then presumably they already like you and they'd be delighted that you're not going through the same 20 minutes.
You get the Radiohead thing of going on, hey, this is if you like me, then you've got to prepare to come with me as I
do
something.
I will do Creep, but...
Yeah, I'll do Creep at the end, if you're good. Yeah. Because you talked a lot about hunt sabbing and stuff like that. Do you still have a political kind of agenda? I've not seen you do any kind of political specific comedy, but
yeah, I do. I've shied away from overtly doing stuff about it for a long time. And also most of it was fairly, when I started out in stand up, I was a bit left wing and so was everybody else. You know, there's no surprises there.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, of course, there's a lot more Canadians with their bizarre right wing agenda. No, there's no, but you know what I mean? There is a lot more diversity in politically on the circuit, and that's probably a good thing. I'm still fairly obvious kind of lefty. I'm still a vegetarian. I'm non-religious.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing a chunk of stuff at the moment about faith.
Okay.
So that's the closest I've got probably to an overt bit of here's my opinion on this thing, you know. But it's luckily it's funny, so I think that makes it, you don't feel like you're being lectured, hopefully.
When the demon comes out, when you get on one on stage, do you ever get on one around existing material? Might you kind of go, right, I'm on it now and I know I've got some stuff on faith, so now I'm going to just pick bits out of that and do it? Or does it go somewhere completely other than your material? Does it go to...
Somewhere completely other than my material. The thing that keeps happening is that I've got the demon rolling and it's fine and it's kind of hitting... It's mostly hitting the ons and not the offs. And my other sensible head says, well... Okay, we've had a bit of fun. Better get back to the material, don't you think?
Yeah.
Shall we do the act? Shall we? Come on. And then I tend to think, right, okay, well, I've freewheeled for 10 minutes. I better do 5 minutes of stuff. And that can be, as you probably know yourself, very, very tricky.
Yes.
To get back into the material because suddenly the material can look clunky in comparison, you know?
Yes. Here's an opinion I thought about and wrote down. Yeah. We're actually there thinking, no, we're watching you be electric and run around naked.
Yeah.
Why are you going to start telling us about, you know...
Yeah, why have you put your pants on?
Yeah, why have you put your pants back on? Leave the pants off.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, there are some people who can do that very skillfully. I think with me, it's slightly clunkier. And often I've been told, again, I've come off stage and mates, circuit friends and promoters have said, you didn't need to, that was great, by the way, but you didn't need to go back into your prepared material it was all working. So why, you know, and I'm just thinking, well, can I do that for 20 minutes and still get paid? Because that just seems too much fun, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, when you're emceeing, you can do that, except that I always think MCs should do something that sounds like a set-up punchline.
Yes, to get everyone in the group.
Just so the audience knows that's what most people are going to be doing, you know.
But so you haven't, to date, you haven't gone out and demoned it for 20 minutes? or your set or your closing thing and actually finished like that and just ended up going, wow, there we go, that's the end?
How
does that feel to you?
I've done 40 minutes whereby 30 minutes was demon.
Okay.
And I still...
And you still brought it back to jokes.
I still think I'd better do some jokes. It's not necessarily at the end like that, tacked on, but in amongst it, I do a bit of set. And it's partly because I want to demonstrate that I am a proper comic that writes jokes. Because I,
to who?
To some of the people in the room who might think, he's just mucking about.
So what?
Well, I don't, I know.
Like some of them want you to put your pants on.
Yeah.
So what?
Yeah. And but there you go. There's a bit of me that wants to please them all somehow.
Yeah.
If that's possible, yeah, then I'll try and do
on
it.
On top of all this, I've also got some attractive pants.
Yeah. Yeah.
For the purists.
I think we've seen enough of the knob.
Yeah.
Let's pop that away. Which I think really would be people's reaction. It's a phobia, really. It's a kind of stand-up comedy should be equal parts this and equal parts that, but actually as I'm getting older and as I said earlier, it's becoming more and more apparent that I need to get back to the unpredictable nature of the where I started, really, right back at the beginning, you know, the
when
nothing
mattered.
I wonder what I'm going to do. I've got and also for someone who isn't a 500 page a day writer, it suits me just fine. You know, if the stuff's all sort of being stored constantly in my backup disk,
sure,
and I can just unload it as and when.
Yeah. That'd be good. That would make for no feeling guilty about not writing ever.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be a good feeling?
Well, maybe that's what I'm doing here. You know, maybe that's what this whole thing is about. It's just it's a way of me being able to say, oh, well, I don't have to tell you how much I write or don't write, because that's sort of irrelevant, because I'm a thinker and a creator. But I'd love to wake up every day with five excellent jokes that I could, you know, but they don't come thick and fast like that. And it might just be that I'm not designed to be that kind of performer.
Mm-hmm.
But like you say, it's really nice to have one-liners that, a lot of my one-liners don't fit into my act at all. There's no obvious place to put them. But when you get one of those little lulls that you can't explain, it's
suddenly
great.
Back pocket, wallet, we're off. Yeah.
Do you think it was the mermaids who invented the titwank? You know, bang.
Yeah.
But it can be, you know, it can also wrong foot you, because you think, they think, oh, is this a one liner guy or is he a improviser? What is this bloke? And I think it's because I didn't have any disciplined approach to the thing of making people laugh. I just wanted them to laugh. So I haven't ended up with a very disciplined act.
Yeah. You don't have an agenda other than, I mean, you're not trying to express something tangible about the way you see the world. You're not trying to express a political...
No, I mean, I'd like to do all those things, I think. There's a bit of me, you know, like kind of Tony Hancock ended up sort of hating himself because he was a clown, you know.
Mm.
He wanted to be... You know, people laughed at him and made him rich and famous, and then eventually he'd be like, why are they laughing at me?
Mm.
I'm a proper actor, aren't I? I mean, I'm a performer. And it was... I think there's an element of that in a lot of comics that we're actually, there's a bit of us thinking, yeah, but I would like to be more important. Maybe I'll be a playwright. Maybe I'll write a book.
Yeah, it can all suddenly seem to be sort of thrown into quite unpleasant relief, can't it? If you're like, oh, I've just absolutely smashed that gig. And then you go, what does that actually mean in the real world?
Yeah.
Like, hasn't changed anyone's life other than some people enjoyed themselves for a bit.
Well, it's,
I enjoyed myself.
It's shockingly transient, isn't it?
And
all those smashed gigs are only in the tiny grey cells of you and I and one or two mad punters.
But my pet theory is my pet theory is that that's why stand-up comedians are so awful socially. That's why when you ask a stand-up comic, how are you, we go, oh, I'm great, thanks. Roofed it last night.
Yes.
Smashed it. Oh, I just had a great time in Dubai. Just, do you know what I mean? Because you can't say, you can't go, there's the proof.
There's
the statue I made. There's the painting. There's the house I built. You can't say it. It was like, oh, there was all this smoke and mirrors. You should have been there, but you never can have been.
Yeah. It's a very short-lived drug, isn't it? Hence the need for more of it, more often. And you just wish all the people who were in the room that night when you smashed that gig could follow you around going, yeah, you should have seen him.
You should have seen him.
I mean, he really was something else. But, you know, and you don't want to be the person to have to say it, do you? Although, as you say, some people are
adept at pointing it out.
Oh, I blew the roof off. Really?
Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you, Stuart.
That's brilliant. I've really enjoyed that. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Mr. Ben Norris. Is there anything you'd like to plug? Should we direct people to your website? Or
I have a website, www.bennorris.co.uk. I have...
You've got a secondary website regarding your love of chairs.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I do. There's a connection, what do you call it, a link to my other website, which is still in its infancy, but it's about my other obsession of being mid-century modern architecture and design.
It's genuinely lovely, and I recommend everyone go to it. Brit60.com,
is it?
.com, possibly.
I think so.
You'll find it. There's a link on Ben's old site.
And there's pictures of some chairs and lamps.
That is a fascinating insight into the background of Ben Norrison how he talks when he's not on one. That's the opposite of the demon.
Oh, he's off one.
The upholsterer. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Cheers, mate.
So that was Ben Norris. I hope you enjoyed it. I got lots out of that chat. I love the idea of running into battle naked and trying to convince yourself not to put your pants back on. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. As I said, the next episode is going to be in 2 weeks' time with the wonderful Paul Sinner. And after that, Mr. Adam Bloom is going to be telling us all basically how comedy works from scratch. So I hope you enjoy those. Any questions, tweet me at ComComPod or email me info@comedianscomedian.com. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Last thing, of course, is just to thank everyone involved in the creation of the Comedians Comedian podcast, primarily Graham Crockford and Tom Wateracre for their technical support. Thanks to my guest today, Ben Norris, and also thank you to Entertain for their support as well. Thanks for listening. Speak to you soon.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.